time for comments and questions.
My name is Maja Dragic and I'm coming from Montenegro, ex-socialist country, as Poland is. And I also got the opportunity to visit Poland, to be at CASE as one of the institutes that was kind of leading institutional reforms in Poland. And you were talking a lot about institutions. And I'll ask you, what is, when you are talking about institutions, I suppose you are referring both to formal institutions and informal institutions. Because when you think of transition as a process that is going on still in the countries that we usually refer to as transitional, we are the witnesses of the fact that institutional reforms have succeeded more in the sense that new institutions were adopted more easily if they were somehow in less conflicting with the old informal institutions. So this relation between formal and informal institution is described in Steve Perich's interaction thesis. He says that the transition, Steve Perich interaction thesis, he says that the transition is more successful if new formal roles, which are induced by new institutions, are not conflicting with non-formal rules, thinking, culture, tradition, way of thinking of people. So last night we heard the story about pension reforms in Georgia. And we've heard that people still, in all transition countries, especially people who used to live in socialism, think that the government has to take care about everything. So when you finish school, first the government should pay for your school, and then when you finish school, government should provide you a job and things like that. So when you have that mind, that mindset, then you are not used to new institution. Where is this relation between formal institution and informal institution? How does all of this set into your explanation of crisis? And can we apply this to this crisis thinking, to the solution of crisis? Whether people in Europe are somehow in last years after Second World War used to the state that is supposed to bring them something. Can we use this explanation of transition to this explanation of crisis now? Thank you.
Well, I don't want to engage in definitions of institutions. I can let me on the side that I found it useful to look at institutional regimes, a set of institutions in the country, and then variable features of these regimes are institutional variables, say extent of freedom, or the level of enforcement of laws, or the division of powers, the extent or level. These are institutional variables, which can be to some extent make operational. Fortunately, we have various indices. Freedom House, Fraser Institute, Heritage Foundation, World Bank. So it helps in empirical research, but this is the first thing. Now, and this division into formal and informal is popular. It's not very clear, but useful. Normally, I think people, when they say formal institutions, they mean the government, plus everything which has been recognized by the government. So if you say, if you create a company based on the state law, it is a formal institution, but market is not a formal institution. It's an informal institution, okay? Now, I think in tradition, the most important role, the most important is to change formal institutions. You can't hope that you change quickly by any special techniques in formal institutions. How can you? Would you put the whole nation at school so that to rehabilitate the bad habits of thinking? No. to change from an institution in such a way that it create new incentives. Just an example. Central Granting Common was totally monopolized. So abolish monopolies. And it can be done. We did it in Poland. We opened the economy and we have abolished all the monopolistic organizations. You change incentives. And then people are back. There's something, if you change incentives sufficiently, so even people will change their behavior, even if they don't like it. And then special psychological mechanism may operate, which has been described as a cognitive dissonance. You adapt to integral norms to your behavior. So I think a radical change in formal institutions is the key. And to some extent, informal institutions. And in some important policies, the differences in informal institutions do not matter at all. So the error is hugely exaggerated. If you have hyperinflation, so what do you have to do? You have to reduce the rate of growth of money supply sufficiently radically, and it would work regardless of your culture. You mentioned something which is called usually Homo sovieticus. Yes, so supposedly since people lived under this bad paternalism, the stories goes they have developed certain expectations, etc., etc. Perhaps, but it does not matter very much. These same people would behave differently under radically different conditions. And by the way, I wonder to what extent, where do you have more Homo sovieticus? In the form of social standards, then, or in the West? Well, I coined another expression. This is the mentality of Soviet officials. And this is based on true stories. In the Soviet Union times, there were delegation of Soviet officials which went, say, to the United States, and what had they seen? Shelves full of Coca-Cola, jeans, bananas, cars. What was the typical question? What minister is responsible for the situation? Now, this mentality of Soviet officials is very much alive with respect to the welfare state. Who would care? In the West, too. So without the welfare state, there is no care. So your individual efforts or mutual association just have disappeared from the horizon. So there's a mentality of Soviet officials in the West. And what another empirical indication. Could you name just one country in the West which has introduced flat tax? No. Because it is against political correctness. It is against socialist beliefs. But there are many countries in the former socialist belief which introduced flat tax. Starting with all over. So where is the Homo sovieticus? Where do we have more Homo sovieticus? In the West? So we have flat tax in Ukraine, Russia, Slovakia, Czech Republic. Not in Hungary, because they are close to the Western type of mentality of the Soviet Union. So they are very progressive. So I don't think that one should pay much attention to this mentality questions. Generally speaking, a lot of mentality is hugely overdone. For example, people say Greece crisis it is because of Greek mentality. Nonsense. If you look at Greek economic history, you see that between 1950 and 1974, Greeks were very successful economically. They had low inflation and balanced budget. What has happened next? Papandreou. Papandreou, first Karamanlis were able to social democratic, and Papandreou wanted to be killed, and they destroyed the political culture. They created the culture of entitlement.
He was an economist.
So, well, no. It's very important. He was the worst kind of theoretical economist from ever. He was a great professor in wealth economics. Wealth economics invents new kinds of market failures. What was he said? He has devised Lemon, a basic for Lemon. Well, one can construct a model to show everything, but in reality, he was still by Leo's Strauss. Stiglitz, in his book, which is one of the best in the literature, he still quotes the example of lighthouses as a public goods, even though Coase, years ago, has shown that lighthouses have been financed privately, etc. So it is a whole industry in amazing economics to invent new market failures. And then you can employ this agent protector, the state, to worship.
Okay?
Yes. I want, first of all, to thank Professor Mazarovic. His talks is always so full of insights. It takes time to really digest them. I have a couple of questions. Well, I was intrigued by your analysis of the impact of wrong or stupid narratives creating the conditions for negative shocks, etc. If you apply that analysis to the euro crisis, what would be, in your view, stupid narrative, and if I can add another question, I mean, looking backwards or looking forward, do you think that EU enlargement has been a positive shock or a negative or a neutral shock for countries coming out of the transition?
The second question, well,
I think it was positive to both sides because it injected a new ego. People which were very calm under the Brighton Sanders. Your first question brings me to the second part of my presentation. But let me catch up. In a Eurozone, you have two kinds of crises. I call it because of the sequence. The first one starts with the private sector boom, which spills over into the fiscal because first you have inflated revenues and then you collapse. This is a Spanish case, an Irish case, etc. Fundamental question is what's behind these booms? Now, and the popular interpretation is inherent instability of financial markets. And you have models that show what you inherently unstable, there's an expression of procyclicality. And conclusions are state has to do something. Now, what about empirics of this? Well, you can find, and there's nothing original, just a list from empirical literature. You can find a whole list of wrong policies which have contributed to the credit boom and the ensuing bust. There's no bust without a credit boom. By the way, you can find this more or less in the Delorosier report, which dealt with the diagnosis of the crisis. Now, if you look at actions which have taken, were any of the destructive policies removed? No. Not revision of monetary policy doctrine, so there is not to repeat the Greenspan lowering of interest rate. Very little, only there are some initiatives to deal with you have these still perverse regulations regarding governing the relationship between governments and the banks, etc. So it's still a lot of work to say the least. And the second, let's call it Greek type. Now it starts with it's overspending, which is also financed by debt, which is the fiscal problems for the simple reason that there are financial institutions who lend. The surveys, and here we have these perverse incentives. Basel 1, Basel 2, Basel 3, credit weights, concentration ratios, privileges for the sovereigns. Now the key question is this. What's behind the tendency for systematic overspending? Which differs, of course. Across countries, where it's pretty strong everywhere, I think there is destructive competition, political competition. Many politicians try to be popular by pretending they are Santa Clauses. And they are elected and got worse, they fulfilled their promises. It would be better than if they achieved. None of them fulfilled. And this tendency is present that there are weak constraints on the government. There were constraints which were destroyed. There was a norm of decent government, a balanced budget. It was a moral norm. And it was destroyed in the 20th century. At the same time, you had this. So Peter has analyzed this, by the way, I know. So what are the solutions? Try to change the nature of political competition. Inject the notion of the costs. Unmask demagogues, which is absolutely up all. This battle will never end. So we have a job for life. That's very optimistic. Job for life. and introduce constraints. But you need a very vigilant civil society so that these constraints stay and are not removed, or governments do not cheat. So ultimately, it is the structure of civil society which matters, and no shortcuts. There are, of course, some technical solutions, but in order to introduce the technical solution to maintain them, you have the force. And in every society, you have people who like other people money, and they like protection from competition. And they are active all the time because they have sort of natural incentives. And if there's not a counterweight, they will. Okay, it would have consequences like the Greek oil crisis, stagnation of crisis. So, mobilization and professional mobilization. So, summing up, look, I think that there's a huge bias in the policies in the Eurozone with respect to the crisis. First, there's a belief that salvation would come from Europe. More Europe, you know this new slogan. Previously, we had more socialism. More socialism, it was a solution. If there was a problem, it was because it was not enough socialism. Now we have more Europe. But what does it mean, more Europe? More warm feelings? No, they usually mean more bailouts. More Europe is more bailouts. Can more bailouts solve Italian problems? No. How? It would mean that Mr. Draghi would print and print and print. And so on. And we can learn from experience. European Central Bank has already printed, remember, a euro, 1 trillion. Yes? You remember the euphoria in the markets? It lasted for how many weeks? And the declines? Sorry, yes?
One week.
And after the announcement of the recent policy, euphoria lasted for 3 days. And still the people are claiming this is the solution. No. I think the solutions are, and this is economically feasible, in proper policies. And finally, I would illustrate this point. I see that this is my view, which I presented to the German Minister of Finance. Why this push from ECB is wrong? First of all, it's based on three rhetorical devices. These should not be mistaken for arguments. They are stretching the concept of the rate of last resort. If you look at the textbook before the crisis, there's no interpretation whatsoever that the end of last resort would include money printed to buy government bonds. But it was anathema in all the textbooks. Now it is normal, but only rhetorically. Second, it's typical. This is a very typical. With respect to fiscal stimulus, it was said either there would be fiscal stimulus or a catastrophe. So they enacted fiscal stimulus. The same is in China. It's very popular. Okay. I think these are the longer term consequences. So no lasting solution. I think they are increasing costs with the passage of time. But reforms can work. This is the final illustration. I will speak there. It's not working. Okay. This is my favorite presentation. Comparing bear countries and pigs. Pigs are pretty well known. Yes. And bear are less known. This is Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Now, look, the Baltic countries have suffered a terrible decline in GDP. Why? Because they suffered a huge credit boom. And then they collapsed. But look at the recovery. It's like 19th century recovery, V-shaped. Why is there a differentiation in the things group? The worst is Greece, Portugal and Ireland is much better. Different problems are different from that of Greece. Okay. Now, what's important then? Many people are saying, reforms are necessary, but they can produce results only in the long run. In the short run, we need something else. What? Bailouts. What they overlooked is what I call confidence effects. If you start implementing credit policies, financial markets do react. We know it from experience. Okay, look. And here, look. The bad countries had to pay much more after they declined. They introduced very radical policies, reducing spending, liberalizing if it was necessary, but the market reacted. Why? You see the huge differentiation in regarding PIBs. Yes? So huge. So Ireland should be relegated to the bad group. Portugal to some extent. So productive policies produce shorter term effects too, which are confidence effects. So instead of worshipping European Central Bank or pressing it, focus on reforms in your countries. So as to remain, it is a very long story when IMF lends. Lends first to facilitate better policies in your country so your country can regain access to the markets. But it is not the credit by policies which matters. Okay. Huge adjustment in current account. Bulgaria and incredible, 20% of GDP. Why? Because there was no cheap money from European Central Bank. So they had to adjust. And they did.
Sorry.
I have a question about China. How do you consider China, the development of China, as one of the factors, if it is, of the financial crisis? How do you think China could have contributed to the imbalances, world imbalances, and the crisis? And the second one is connected to this. This one is where do you put China in your this Chinese system in your model? Because it's not, of course, a free market, no socialism, nobody knows what it is.
On the first question, speaking about Chinese current account, one should distinguish between centers vis-a-vis the United States and the general centers, which is much smaller. There is a special problem in the relationship between China and U.S., but not a sort of general problem. And by the way, why surplus is all of a sudden should be a bad thing? Should we come to equalization, forceful equalization of current accounts? Which ones are proper and cheap, which ones are improper? This should not be, cannot be decided by Fiat or by Financial Times. Which says every surplus countries are delinquent. So I don't, on the first question, on the second question, if you look at China after the Second World War, since 1950, you see two different periods. The first is Maoism, which was socialist plan with a tyrant on the top. And China was not catching up with the West. China was growing very slowly on average. So there was no Chinese in Europe then. And then there was a change. If you look at the figures, one can say that China has been moving in the direction of white capitalism. with large mixture of crony capitalism intertwined with public ownership, but the change is huge. So what matters in economic growth is not just the level, but the change, and expectations that the change creates. So I think China is not an evidence that socialism can work. It's an evidence that you have to abandon socialism in order to have their growth. And by the way, let me quote our prophet, Ludwig von Mises. He said that the only effective reform of socialism is introduction of capitalism. And I think China proves that. No, it's a big question mark about the future, whether this is irreversible or not, but so far, what has China achieved was built in the fact that they were reducing the scope of socialism. China has some special advantages at the beginning which were not existing in Russia. So it's unfair just to compare. First, China, being a poor country, was dominated by agriculture. Chinese agriculture was organized in a huge and nonsensical Maoist commons, which were easily to be disbanded. And it was pretty easy to reintroduce de facto quasi-private ownership among the farmers, which constituted the majority of working population. So this was the most radical shock therapy in the world. Which contrasts with the usual story that China proves that graduates work. In this regard, now this condition in China did not exist in Russia. Russia was a badly developed country. Agriculture constituted a small part and was hugely inefficient. So China, Russia could not obtain this initial boost, which was a very, very big challenge.
Maybe one last, I don't know. Just a couple of observations. You know, I think we make a big thing about the balance of payment deficit in Europe. You know, we should not forget that the United States had a deficit in the balance of payment just before the crisis, which was approaching 7% of GDP. Australia, which was not a part of the European Union, had a balance of payment of 10% of GDP. So there have been many, many cases in the world outside of the European Monetary Union where this has happened. The difference is whether this is comes because you are investing too much or you are spending too much. You know, in the case of the pigs, as you said, I would leave out maybe Italy, because it's not a pig, it's a dog or something like that. But you know, in the case of the European, clearly, either they were really very bad investments. In the case of Spain, or Ireland, over investing in houses, and which nobody wanted, you know. Or well, if you make bad investment, clearly, I don't see what the Euro or European Monetary Union has to do with this. You know. But this was one observation. The only one I would make is more directly related to your presentation, which I enjoyed a lot, and I agree with much of most of it. But the point of institution, you know, you gave a lot of importance to institution. And I want to tell a story when we were advising Russia in the 90s. You know, we thought one of the big problems was revenue. They could not raise enough tax revenue. And so in my department, there was a division which dealt with tax administration. And they developed this technique of what was called large taxpayer unit. Large taxpayer unit means that you develop a good system for very large taxpayers. You begin to check them much more closely, etc. Once you have developed this system from the top 100, you go to 500, 1,000. Progressively, you work the same system down. So we advise the Russians to do this. And at some point, an Australian advisor of the department went to Russia, and there was a big sign on the door which said what large taxpayer unit. And they found out that the only change, only thing that had ever changed was the sign on the door. Nothing else had ever changed. So which brings me to the question of institution. You know, we could call an institution, let's call an institution a dog. And the two countries adopt this institution called dog. But in one country it's a poodle, in the other country it's a Great Dane. And that's the problem, that sometimes, you know, it's the people that make real institution. You know, we have some, perhaps we have the, this is not a comment on your presentation, but a general observation, that we have a view that there is something close, called an institution, bring it to Hungary, and somehow the Hungarian will immediately observe like a fiscal council. So this is where to recognize that sometimes words hide the real tremendous differences.
On the current account, I largely agree. On the second point, I think that there's a link between problems in some Eurozone and some features of Euro, and it's not design but implementation. And let me explain overlapping my day. First, Germany did not benefit from the entering the Eurozone in the sense that interest rate Germany had to pay had not been lowered because Germany was disciplined before. Who obtained the winnable gain? Southern countries, Portugal, Greece, Italy, and Spain. Now, everybody realizes that fiscal discipline is one of the necessary conditions for proper functioning of Euro, and this is why the stability and the respect was introduced, but you know it was violated. Is it the fault of implementation of the design? Probably both, because from the very beginning, Germans wanted the sanctions for violating the threshold to be automatic. But French objected and prevailed. So without automatic sanctions, if sanctions are enacted by the potential sinners, the probability of them being enacted is pretty low. So this is one thing. It does not mean that Europe cannot be rescued, but it means that fiscal discipline should be entrenched in the respective countries. With a large this participation of civil society is indispensable in this endeavor. Second, this is a problem of interest rates in the monetary union with one obviously central bank. I remember the studies of the potential effects of Euro. Two of them were made to the Poland Central Bank, one by IMF. And with the benefit of hindsight, I can say there was at least one error. It was mentioned that thanks to Euro, interest rates would be reduced. And this has been presented as an unmitigated plus. So there was no mention, to my knowledge, that this can be risky because it can fuel the asset bubble. And I think it is not an accident that it was Spain and Ireland which suffered from the asset bubble. So if we assume that some natural interest rates for some countries, present or future, in the Eurozone would be too low, then we should think about compensating mechanisms, which are called general macroprudential regulations. It's a lot of technical work. And I think this is something, for me at least, new. That one should, so the low interest rates for some countries are dangerous. And on your remark on institutions, I understand you say that if certain institutions is not implemented, it's not effective. Of course. Because so if you just label something without putting it into practice, it does not exist as an institution. But I would, the fact that certain institutions were not de facto introduced in Russia, it does not necessarily follow from the Russian mentality. No. There was a very much less time in Russia to introduce new institutions than in Poland. We have, for the first time when I was in charge of economic reforms in Poland, we have 800 days, 2.5 years. So with proper concentration and proper team, you can do a lot, not everything, but a lot. My friend who recently deceased, Igor Gaidar, had at most a year. So much, much, much less. If you read, remember Russian history, there was a period when Russia was reformed, beginning of the 20th century, and they started to build a very honest administration. But then you have this terrible accident, First World War and October Revolution.
comments?
In the last years, I had some opportunities to meet with some persons who are still involved in financial organizations and so on, who are running organizations, even banks, even local national banks. And in discussing with them, really I observed that they felt culprit. They felt culprit for that they have considered that they were in some way responsible of the crisis. And but I would say really this was very strange because I am not specialized in finance, and because I have no heard one person around my knowledge that defended finance. I happened many times in my own classrooms to defend finance. And looking at the newspapers, for instance, I scarcely observed even one paper defending finance. So it's really puzzling that no one specialized in finance defended the virtues of financial innovations and so on. Why do they feel culprit themselves for the crisis and so on? Do you have the same feeling about this kind of strange behavior? And would that be a kind of illustration of chronic capitalism?
Well, if I understood you properly, you said that some bankers, whom you meet, are morally responsible for the financial crisis, yes? This means that they are more honest than the politicians. Have you ever met a politician who said, I am responsible for contributors to the crisis?
No.
I haven't.
No.
You see. So this brings us to the question, empirical question, whether the percentage of cheaters is high among the bankers or among the politicians. But it is the politicians who bank the bankers, not vice versa. Why? Because most of the public probably likes politicians to bash the bankers. I'm not defending the bankers, I'm just making some observations. The popular culture is such that I think it has to do with this popular, this is primitive fallacy that since financial crisis is present in the financial sector, it must be the financial sector which is responsible for the crisis. But this is a primitive fallacy to deduce this. But as I said, since sneezing is in the nose is responsible for the sneezing. This is the same analogy. But it's a very appealing. Appealing, simple, powerful, wrong logic. Second, of course that some of these bankers make huge errors. Some of them did not understand what they were doing. Some of them played bridge instead of trying. As far as I remember, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, he was very fond of playing bridge. Well, of course, so it is not to defend individuals, but to try to explain why they made errors. And then you have to look at incentives. And the question, to what extent incentives were distorted by the public policies? And they were, it's like say, under socialism, polls were not working very hard. So a supervision observer would say, because they are lazy. No, it was because of socialism. Okay, they are not working very hard. Now they are working quite hard, because incentives. They are rewarded for hard work. They were not rewarded for hard work on the socialism. And one more thing. I remember when I was in the US in the 70s, there was industrial conglomerates were very fashionable. And they were heroes. are eliminated by the market. Financial conglomerates have not been eliminated by the market because the market was broke. So something which grew dysfunctionally is not eliminated neither by the market nor by the authorities. By the market, because you have to bid to fail, etc., etc., these perverse regulations. But the financial conglomerates are blamed on what? On the market. Even though they are not the product of the market, they are the product of the distorted behavior of market participants. But many people call market fail whatever the distorted market fail. So they will give you another price.